It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Now our 30 Issues election series continues with Issue 4. The government should mandate paid family and medical leave, unless it shouldn't. It's easy to find disagreement on the issue this campaign season. Just listen to presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton.
If fighting for women's health care and paid family leave and equal pay is playing the woman card, then deal me in.
And listen to vice presidential hopeful Carly Fiorina.
I'm not saying I oppose paid maternity leave. What I'm saying is I oppose the federal government mandating paid maternity leave to every company out there.
This is typical Republican scare tactics. We can design a system and pay for it that does not put the burden on small businesses.
So, debate on. The question of what government should require of employers and how they should protect workers, including female workers, is hardly new. The U.S. Labor Department set up a Women's Bureau in 1938 and let the world know.
The Women's Bureau promotes the welfare of women workers. It investigates and reports on all conditions and problems related to women's employment.
Family and medical leave wasn't on the agenda back then. They were more concerned with things like conditions in sweatshops. But in 1943, the government released this film about women entering the workforce to help win World War II.
In war towns all over the United States, women are called upon to leave their homes and take jobs. Among our young unmarried women, and among older women whose children are grown, we have a large reserve. They discover that factory work is usually no more difficult than housework. When married women with small children have to take jobs, everything possible will be done to provide day care for the children.
Paid maternity leave bills were introduced in Congress as early as the 1940s and 50s, but never passed in those days. In the 1970s, five states, including New York and New Jersey, added pregnancy and childbirth to temporary disability insurance programs. Also in the 1970s, as more women were entering the workforce, there was a bill in Congress to go much further to establish a national daycare program, not just new baby care. But President Nixon opposed it. In this clip, Nixon's former aide, Pat Buchanan, quotes Nixon's words explaining why.
For the federal government to plunge headlong financially into supporting child development would commit the vast moral authority of the national government to the side of communal approaches to child rearing over against the family-centered approach.
Communal approaches. So daycare by professionals was rejected by Richard Nixon as anti-family. Only a parent should do that during the workday. Almost always, of course, the mother. Donald Trump was asked about the issue of daycare by a woman at a town hall meeting before the Iowa caucuses. He apparently hadn't been briefed yet on possible roles for government.
And you know, it's not expensive for a company to do it. You need one person or two people, and you need some blocks. And you need some swings and some toys. You know, it's really, it's not expensive. It's not an expensive thing. And I do it all over. And I get great people because of it, because it's a problem with a lot of other companies. So anyway, but it's something that can be done, I think, very easily by a company.
Trump at that time seemed to only have one American's child care on his mind.
But I said, Ivanka, it would be so great if you had your baby in Iowa. It would be so great. I'd definitely win.
It took until the late 1980s for family and medical leave to make it more to the center of national politics, and it took a woman to make it a presidential campaign issue. Democratic Congresswoman Pat Schroeder of Colorado briefly considered running in the 1988 Democratic primaries. Ultimately, she did not enter the race, but while she was thinking about it, she said this in 1987, tying the temporary family leave and the ongoing child care issue together.
We don't have a family medical leave policy. We don't have a child care policy. We're still pretending like women are in the workplace because they're bored. 9 out of 10 women must be in the workplace because they have to be in the workplace. Only 1 out of 10 have the option to decide whether they want to be.
Congresswoman Pat Schroeder in 1987. Then the real drama started. Twice during the term of the first President Bush, Congress passed bills to require unpaid family and medical leave, up to 12 weeks in a year in companies with 50 employees or more, and you've worked there for a year. Twice Congress passed it, and twice President George H.W. Bush vetoed it. Here is a disappointed Senator Christopher Dodd, Democrat from Connecticut.
The president had a chance to make an old campaign promise, the new law of the land, to break new ground, to replace the rhetoric of family values that we've heard so much of in the last number of months with real policy that values families, to provide working parents with the same job security that every industrialized nation in the world provides.
Senator Dodd of Connecticut in 1992 voting to override President Bush's veto. Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah voted to uphold it.
The Family and Medical Leave Act is packaged as a pro-family, all-American piece of legislation. But once you strip away the fancy ribbons and the brightly colored bows, what you have is an unprecedented, inflexible, government-mandated employee benefit that will strangle both individual and employer flexibility in addressing workplace needs.
Senator Orrin Hatch, in 1992, helping to uphold the Family and Medical Act veto as President Bush was running for re-election. His opponent that year, Bill Clinton, who made family and medical leave a centerpiece of his campaign. Clinton, of course, won that election, and as he promised on the campaign trail, made his very first bill signing, the Family and Medical Leave Act, on February 5th, 1993.
Family and medical leave has always had the support of a majority of Americans from every part of the country, from every walk of life, from both political parties. But some people opposed it, and they were powerful, and it took 8 years and two vetoes to make this legislation the law of the land. Now millions of our people will no longer have to choose between their jobs and their families. The law guarantees the right of up to 12 weeks of unpaid leave per year when it's urgently needed at home to care for a newborn child or an ill family member. This bill will strengthen our families, and I believe it will strengthen our businesses and our economy as well.
President Bill Clinton in 1993. And again, that only guaranteed unpaid leave. Today, paid family leave and medical leave is considered an issue for women and men. Governor Andrew Cuomo spoke of caring for his dying father, Mario, as Andrew signed a paid family and medical leave act earlier this year for New York State.
And I have kicked myself every day that I didn't spend more time with my father at that end period. I could have. I'm lucky. I could have taken off work. I could have cut days in half. It was my mistake, and a mistake I blame myself for every day. But there are many people in this state who don't have the choice. Parent is dying, child is sick. They can't take off work. Their employer says, if you don't come, you're fired. If you don't get paid. This is not where New York should be.
So for now, paid family and medical leave remains up to the states as the presidential candidates debate it for the nation. Maybe by now, unlike in that clip before the Iowa caucuses, Donald Trump has figured out a position. And that's our very brief and partial history of family and medical leave as a presidential issue. Sociology professor at the CUNY Graduate Center and author joins us now, Ruth Milkman, to tell us more. She's the author of Unfinished Business, Paid Family Leave in California and the Future of U.S. Work Family Policy, and On Gender, Labor, and Inequality, Working Class in American History, which comes out in paperback this July. She's a professor of sociology at the CUNY Graduate Center. Professor Milkman, welcome back to WNYC. Hi.
Thank you, Brian, for having me.
Why'd you single out California for a book? Was it especially groundbreaking?
It was the first state and the first part of the United States to create a paid family leave program back in 1992. The legislation was passed, and so that's why we studied it. Yeah.
How does the New York law, just signed by Governor Cuomo, compare to California's?
Well, it improves on it in some respects. The California law, it's very similar in its basic structure, But one difference is that the California law does not include job protection. In other words, unless they're covered by some other legislation, which many workers are, there's no guarantee that the worker's job will be waiting for her or him after a paid leave in California. And in New York, that provision is included. So that's really, you know, an improvement. And it also goes eventually for a longer period of time than the California program is for 6 weeks of partial wage replacement. And in New York, once it's fully implemented, which isn't for a while in 2021, it will be 12 weeks. And, so those are both improvements.
And before we get back to the presidential campaign and the federal debate, how about New Jersey? I read on the website Employment Law HQ that New Jersey's Family Leave Act is similar to the federal one, but in general regarded as more comprehensive because employees in New Jersey are allowed to combine entitlements under both state and federal laws to maximize the length of their leave. Do you know any more specifics about New Jersey?
Yeah, it's not like the federal because it's a paid leave program. It's actually closely modeled after the California program. New Jersey was the second state to pass it. So basically the background to this is there are five states, and as well as Puerto Rico, that have temporary disability insurance programs, and building on the administrative machinery involved in those, four of them have now passed paid family leave programs. So it's in this order: California, then New Jersey, then Rhode Island, and now New York, and the fifth one is Hawaii, which is considering it. Washington State actually passed a paid family leave program but never appropriated money to implement it, so that's sort of an abstract promise right now. But anyway, they're all vaguely similar, and they're what they have in common that I think is really important is that they're insurance programs. That is, the assumption is most people at some point, just like if you own a car, you might be in a car accident. Most workers might need a bit of paid time off at some point, either for a new baby or to care for a seriously ill family member. And so this provides insurance, quote unquote, for that purpose. In New Jersey, the word insurance is actually in the name of the program. It isn't in some of the other states. And, so that's the concept.
And the proposal now before the Senate in Washington, and the more progressive on thinking on this in general, wants to move away from an insurance model?
No, actually, the proposed Family Act, which is the federal legislation that's been languishing for a few years now in Congress, is actually very similar to these state programs. So whereas those are administered by the existing temporary disability insurance agencies that run those programs, this would be administered by an office within the Social Security Administration. And they're all supported by payroll contributions. So just like you pay auto insurance premiums or whatever, you would pay insurance premiums for this. It's similar to Social Security in that respect.
And am I right that the Family and Medical Leave Act, as it stands now at the federal level, only applies to companies with 50 workers or more?
That's correct, whereas the state laws and the proposed Family Act would be universal in coverage. They would cover everyone, part-time workers, full-time workers, and so on. So, yeah, that would be a big improvement. So the way it works out with the existing federal law, the one you described in your historical account and that was passed in 1993, the FMLA, First of all, it's unpaid leave, which a lot of people can't afford to take.
Right.
And it basically, because of the carve-outs, there's also a requirement that you have to work there a certain amount of time and a certain number of hours and so on per week. Only about half the workforce is covered by that anyway, and for the majority of people, they can't afford it. So the paid leave is what's, you know.
So really the two big issues now are whether to progress to a paid Family and Medical Leave Act at the federal level and whether to cover more of those workers who work for smaller companies.
Exactly. And if it's administered as the state programs are through Social Security or something like that, through a payroll tax, the employer is actually not directly involved. In other words, it's administered by the government and you get the benefit from the government just like you do with Social Security. So there's no reason to exclude any particular employer. The logic of the exclusion under FMLA was that, you know, the employer had to administer it and it would be a burden on small business, which isn't necessarily the case.
There's a new tax in New York State that goes along with this, payroll tax.
A very small payroll tax. And the reason it's so small, as in the other states that already have done this, is that while most people will have a kid at some point in their careers, the incidence of in any given year, the likelihood that anyone's going to draw on this benefit is relatively small. So you're paying into it every month for something, for an event that might happen a few times in the course of a, you know, 50-year working career or something like that. So that's why it's very inexpensive.
It's a classic insurance model or a socialized benefit model. Is that what the federal law or the bill that's now before the Senate would involve, an additional little payroll tax for all American workers?
That's correct. Only the difference is in the proposed Family Act. That's the national bill that's, like I said, languishing in Congress. It would actually be split, the payroll contributions, like Social Security, between the worker and the employer, which is different from the New York and California programs, which both are only a tax on workers. In my view, it doesn't really matter because the employer is going to extract that tax from the worker back if they are required to pay it. You know, people will get raises less frequently or something like that. So that's sort of not an important difference. But anyway, that is one difference in the federal proposed law, which, of course, is subject to negotiation still. So who knows what it will end up like if it ever passes.
We're talking about the history and present state of family and medical leave as an issue in presidential campaigns and at the state level, with sociology professor at the CUNY Graduate Center, Ruth Milkman, author of books including Unfinished Business, Paid Family Leave in California, and the Future of U.S. Work-Family Policy, and On Gender, Labor, and Inequality, Working Class, The Working Class in American History, which comes out in paperback this July. Let's talk about some of the history that we went over in that tape segment. Maybe the biggest thing in the history of this issue is that the first President Bush vetoed it twice. Bill Clinton made it an issue running against him and made it the first bill he signed into law when he got inaugurated in 1993. What did Bush have against unpaid 12 weeks of family leave or medical leave for your own illness as a federal guarantee?
Well, I can't read the first Bush's mind, but the lobbyists who opposed it were from the business world. And that was true of all the state laws for paid leave that have been passed as well. So the chambers of commerce, groups like that, are the ones who oppose it. If you look at polling data, the vast majority of Americans on both sides of the aisle, even, you know, older white male religious conservatives, the majority of them support paid family leave. The only opposition comes from organized business, and they make arguments which our research shows are groundless, but they claim that, you know, this will be impossible for businesses to survive and that the sky will fall on the U.S. economy if such laws exist. We know that every country but the United States in the advanced capitalist world has paid family leave of some kind and has had it for many decades. And now we have four states that have it, and the sky has not fallen. So, you know, those arguments are problematic. But as you know, the business community, the chambers of commerce and so on, oppose any kind of labor legislation, not just this, routinely. They don't really want the government telling them what to do. And although in this case, they don't really have to do much except, you know, take the person back after they go away.
And I guess as we heard in those clips of Senator Dodd and Senator Hatch from 1992, there was a majority of Congress enough to pass the bill and send it to the president's desk twice, the first President Bush. But when he vetoed it, they didn't have a big enough majority to override it.
That's correct. So, you know, the other issue here that we haven't really touched on, but I think is really important, is that this very much intersects with the big issue of the day, that is inequality in the United States. Because the way it is now, in the absence of paid leave, many workers do have paid leave, but they tend to be the more privileged workers, so the ones that employers consider valuable to retain. So many employers do provide for, you know, managers and professionals some kind of paid leave. It may not be called paid family leave, but they offer something like that. But to low-wage workers typically have nothing. And so these programs, these government programs, would fix that and level the playing field. And, you know, that has already been the case in the states that have begun to roll these things out. And that's what the Family Act would do, because they are universal. They cover everyone. So it's not just a voluntary act by an employer who really doesn't want to lose, you know, some valuable attorney on their staff and therefore offers her or him some kind of paid leave. This is for everyone.
In the 1970s, when New York, New Jersey, and three other states first included maternity leave in their disability insurance program, from a labeling perspective, it was disability. Today, we like to think of having a baby as normal and healthy, not a disability.
Yes.
But on a benefits level, maybe it's still, I don't know if it still has that label in the New York law, but how does the New York bill cover men?
It doesn't cover them as disabled. So the U.S. is very peculiar in that pregnancy is considered a disability. That's a whole complicated history, which we probably don't have time to get into. But for the paid family leave, as opposed to pregnancy leave, which is what was implemented in New York and those other states in the 70s, the new paid family leave thing is available to men bonding with a new baby or caring for a seriously ill family member, just as it is to women. And in fact, if there are, you know, a male and female parent in the household of the same child, they can take it sequentially as long as they're, you know, providing care for that baby. So it's gender neutral, and that's true in all the other states that have it as well as the proposed federal law.
And so under the law, men could also take off the same amount of time to care for an elderly relative as well, though, of course, that too tends to be women.
Yes, but they could. And actually, in California, which has had this the longest since 2004 when they first implemented it, the percentages of men who are eligible who are taking up the benefit has gone steadily upward. So there's a lot of interest among especially younger male workers in doing this, particularly for new babies. And by the way, the relative does not have to be elderly. It can be any sick family member, including a child.
Ruth Milkman, sociology professor at the CUNY Graduate Center, and author of books including On Gender, Labor, and Inequality, which comes out in paperback this July. Thank you very much for joining us and helping us talk about the history and current state of family and medical leave in the United States.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And that's part one in our 30 Issues series for this week on this issue. Tomorrow, we'll compare countries around the world on their family and medical leave policies. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up next. Angela Duckworth, who, if you've heard the word grit used a lot in the last few years with respect to kids in school, it's her fault. And we'll talk to Angela Duckworth about grit next.